My name is Phil Schrader, and I'm basically, I think, a campus pastor. That's what I was doing in Columbus at Ohio State for 9 years. I'm now at Valparaiso University, but I'm not teaching there, and I'm not the chaplain there. I'm directing a center for the study of campus ministry there, and that's why I continue to think of myself as a campus minister. There's some similarity between what Walt is doing and what I hope to do. There's some dissimilarity too. One of the things I've always appreciated about his style and his theology is that it's terribly experiential, and I think you perceived that this morning. He's really working to help us unpack our experience and to find both the threat of God that is in it and the relevance and the value of the promise of God as it speaks to our real lived situation. I want to try to help us unpack some of our lived experience too, not in as clearly and explicitly a theological way as he does, and in that sense these might provide some balance for one another. I want to take the next 3 mornings to talk about 3 basic movements. 3 basic movements of the Christian spirit, of the Christian faith. First of all, the movement from loneliness to solitude. And secondly, tomorrow, the movement from hostility to hospitality. And then finally, on the third day, the movement from illusion to prayer. And some of you may recognize those words as the key terms of a man named Henry Nouwen. I've written his name on the board behind me. He is a Roman Catholic priest and a teacher at Yale University who's done a lot of creative explicating of this sort of stuff of human existence and as it looks from within the Christian framework. So if there is some stuff here that might be worth your pursuing when these 3 mornings are over, it may be possible to point you to some of his writings, although I don't know that he has written anything complete and substantial on this yet. I suspect it will be coming. But at least we can acquaint you with some of the things that he has done if you're interested in pursuing. I think it's not terribly important who discovered it or where it's coming from, because what we hope to do is to take this and use it to understand what's going on with us and maybe to make some new things or to help or to encourage some new things begin to happen with us. I'm not terribly anxious to persuade you of anything. I don't have any need to convince you or convert you to anything. I suppose the question that stands over the top of all I'm going to say, and it'll come at the end, is simply, isn't it so? We've probably all experienced the value that comes from somebody who isn't theorizing with us, who isn't laying out abstractions and all that, but who's simply telling us how it has been with him. And I think it's that kind of free sharing that we might do here. I hope that we will have a substantial piece of time when I'm done talking so that we can do some of that together, and I hope that my scratched out notes here will keep me enough on course and keep me from rambling so that we do have time for that before the coffee break. The basic question that I invite you to reflect on in these days is simply, what does it mean for me to live life in the Spirit of Jesus Christ? I think that's a good question for us to reflect on in a place like this. I've not been to Holden before, but it seems a unique kind of place for giving yourself some space to think and reflect about that. What does it mean for me to live a life in the Spirit of Jesus Christ? It's an important question, but it often goes unreflected upon, unanswered. It just happens, you know. a good question for us to share some dialogue on, for us to talk to one another about, so that we're not just left with our own monologue, as fruitful but also as limited as that monologue may be. We're dealing with what are our goals in life. And I don't know how you articulate or thematize those for yourself. Success, or inner peace, or creative relations with others, or some experience of God. We're dealing with our handicaps, our limitations, our pains. We're dealing with our struggle to get from where we are to where we're trying to go. And as we do that, we find that each of us has his own unique shape, his own unique story, and yet there's something very common in all of that, so that as we talk with one another, worlds begin to open up, new possibilities begin to open up, and we see some new directions, and we maybe even feel some new strength and some new encouragement and power to go. All of this is taking place in the context of Christian community, very much so. And I think that means that we want to encourage one another. We don't want to indulge one another. We don't want to moralize together. But we are interested and open to knowing one another, to accepting one another, even in all the pain and hurt and ambiguity, to affirming and encouraging one another. I want to ask you to reflect on a question. I wonder whether you can identify any basic change in your life, your inner life, your outer life, in the last year. Are you more relaxed or less relaxed than you used to be? Have you had better relationships with others, or have they seemed to deteriorate, get worse in some ways? Have you felt more or less self-confidence, more or less self-acceptance? Henry Nouwen sees life vacillating, you see, always between poles. With regard to ourselves, he sees life vacillating between the pole of loneliness and the pole of solitude. It's not a matter of being in one place and moving to the other place to be there forever, but there's a going and a coming. With regard to our relationships with others, he sees us moving between the pole of hostility and hospitality. And with regard to God, he sees us moving from illusion to prayer. Have you experienced any changes in your inner or your outer life along any of those lines in the last?
I'll go back and start from the beginning.
A very basic theme is that the new life for us is always born out of the old. That's both disappointing and encouraging, I think. It's something of a paradox, but it may help us to embrace our pain a little bit more than we have. And that's a very important thing in this process of moving between the poles. New life for us is born out of the pains of the old. When we're very comfortable, when there's not much pain in our life, it's very easy to stay put, to keep going, to maintain the status quo, to keep things as they are. But when there is pain, when there is discomfort, we don't want to stay there. We want to get away from that. We want to move. And of course, it's possible to move two ways. The movement out of our pain is not always creative, but it may be, and it can be. And I take it that our commitment to one another is to help it to be. And so it is that our pains and our or at least our responses to them, so to speak, guide us into the future. Okay, today let's think just for a time about the movement from loneliness to solitude. They're very interesting words, I think. Take a moment to try to get the feel of each. What is loneliness? What does it feel like? What is solitude? What does it feel like? It's difficult and maybe very painful for us to enter into our experience of loneliness. Try to complete this sentence for yourself. Loneliness is. And now, be concrete. Take an experience, the last days, months. Loneliness is. Loneliness feels like. Try to give it some color, some quality. For me in the past year, loneliness has been being in a place in a crowd of people that were talking animatedly and having nothing to say. For loneliness is moving into a crowd of people where no hands are reaching out. If I put myself in someone else's shoes, or maybe I should say someone else's paws, loneliness is spending a week at the kennel while my family goes off to Holden. Loneliness is spending Christmas Day in the nursing home, having the family come and visit and drop their presents on me, and then go back to celebrate their own. What's your experience? How would you finish the sentence? Loneliness is, loneliness feels like. Maybe some of these experiences, which aren't necessarily mine, but maybe some of ours, can help you to unpack what we're talking about. You're cross-eyed, and your classmates laugh at you, and they call you names. You're the last person to be picked for the softball game, or the volleyball game, or the soccer team. You're a refugee from Vietnam in the United States, which doesn't know whether to welcome you or to send you back. Some of you maybe are teachers. You stand up to speak, and the students don't respond. You stand up to speak in a faculty meeting, and your colleagues pay little attention, give little recognition to what you have said. What are the places of your loneliness? Classroom? A crowd? A party to which you've gone hoping for excitement, friendship, intimacy, and from which you walk away empty, sad? Reading a book, but finding yourself spending more time staring away from it, out of your loneliness into the empty space? I would guess that loneliness is pretty universal for human beings. If some of you are familiar with other societies and you know societies where people don't experience something like what we're calling loneliness, it might be interesting to hear about that and reflect on it. But it seems to be pretty universal. Nevertheless, our loneliness has, I think, a uniquely Western shape to it. Our society, our culture is, to oversimplify the whole thing, very fast, very busy, very competitive, full of all kinds of distractions, full of all kinds of, I'll use a theological word, idols. And an idol is at least a distraction from a true goal and a distraction from a true pain, perhaps. Think about the pornography in our culture. We might think and talk about and evaluate that differently, but perhaps one of the things pornography does is to provide an escape from loneliness. And the problem with it, the reason we give it a bad name, the reason we put it down is because it's an escape that doesn't work. But it seems to. And in that sense, it becomes a kind of idol, a cheap thrill. The attempt to buy something that you really can't buy. We're doing it all the time. The best things in life are free, but we try to buy them. Intimacy, friendship. At the same time in our culture, we do a lot of talking about unity and togetherness and intimacy. And so I think we express something that we're reaching for, something we're hoping for. We give expression to something that we need and want. It's probably safe to say, and a lot of people have said it, that loneliness is the most frequently expressed complaint in our society. And it's the cause of, it's at the base of so many of our social problems. Suicide, alcoholism, drugs, many of our psychosomatic pains, ills. I frequently get headaches when I'm lonely. Other people get pains in their backs, in their necks. Nouwen talks about some of the language we use to suggest that we are anything but lonely, and he invites us to consider how real that is the times when we really mean it, and how phony it is, the times when we don't know what else to say, and so we say this very intimate kind of thing. Please come in, it's so good to see you. The housewife, the teacher, maybe frantically trying to get through the day, you know, not sitting reading a book waiting for somebody to knock on the door, harried, hurried. Please come in, it's so good to see you. I hope you don't stay too long. Let me introduce you to this special friend who would just love to meet you. I've heard so much about you, how pleased I am at last to meet you. It was so great to talk with you and to visit with you. You know, sometimes we really mean that. It's really good to say, and it really expresses where we're at. What do we say when we feel the other way? What do we say when it wasn't so good to meet you and to visit with you? It was boring, or it was whatever. What do we say then? We don't know what to say, so we maybe say, it was so good to meet you and to visit with you. Some of us don't like to be reminded of our loneliness. We spend a lot of energy in trying to keep it down, in trying to conceal it. We bury our dead people as if they're still alive, and we bury our pains as if they're not really there. So we try to keep them from rearing their ugly and threatening head. We try to stay very busy. I have a daily schedule that is impossible. It's a schedule that I impose on myself, at least 70% to 80% of it. At the end of a day, I always can look back at all the things I haven't done. At no time in the day can I ever say, gee, it's all done, I don't have anything to do, I may freely choose now to do whatever I want. I keep a very busy schedule like that. And there's always much unfinished business. When I moved from Columbus to Valparaiso, I brought along a huge stack of periodicals that I haven't read yet, but I'm going to. A rather long shelf of books that I haven't read yet, but I'm going to. And they're always there. And so I keep myself very busy. And in doing that, I may think to evade, to keep down. But I don't, my loneliness. We were working under the quarter system back at Ohio State, and quarter consisted of about 10 weeks, very intensive periods. From the beginning to the end, you really were driving. You had expectations, you had programs, you had meetings, you had things to produce, and you really drove. You didn't have time to get sick. When did I get sick? Between quarters. Invariably. The pressure was off. I wasn't driving. And it almost got to the point where I expected and I feared it, and I had the feeling that I brought it on just by that. Maybe it wouldn't have come by itself. We try to stay busy, very involved and very active, so that our pain and our loneliness doesn't rise to the surface and threaten us. Well, what do you do with your loneliness? And what is your hope? What is your vision about your loneliness? Are you looking for someone who will take it away? And do you try to do that with other people? Do you try to take away their loneliness? Are you waiting for the time, the place, where there will be no loneliness, where no pain exists, no separation is felt? If we are, we really ought to test the reality of that. Nouwen says, no friend or lover, no husband or wife, no community or commune can put to rest our deepest craving for unity and wholeness. And just look what happens when we carry those expectations around with us. I expect you to take away my loneliness, and when you don't do it, I'm disappointed. I may become accusatory, I may become jealous, and I may become very angry. You have let me down, and I'm angry with you. And if I'm trying to take away your loneliness and I see that I'm not making it, how do I feel? Inadequate. Frustrated. There must be something wrong with me. We yearn for a final solution. We have a new friend. We come into a new community and we invest them with messianic expectations. Maybe this time I will find what I've been searching for. Or we get in some new movement, maybe a new psychological movement or some new social thing. If someone will tell me I'm okay, and if I can only surround myself with enough people who will tell me always I'm okay, maybe then I won't be so lonely. If I could scream primally, maybe then I'd feel better. If I could become more aware of my body, then maybe I could relax more. You know, there's truth in all that. There's a lot of truth, and people have experienced a lot of help and a lot of healing from that. Why have these things arisen in our society? Isn't it because so much of our traditional attitudes, so much of our traditional behavior is so destructive, is so pain-inducing and sickness-producing for us? And so these come along, and they carry suggestions for us. They can be very helpful, and yet very dangerous if we invest them with messianic expectations. We're tempted to believe that our loneliness and our sadness are only signs of a lack of mutual openness. If we could only open up more, our loneliness and our sadness would go away. We're seduced by that because it's partly true. We really experience some relief when we open up. One of Nouwen's basic themes is that any mutual openness like this needs to be balanced by a mutual respectful protection of each other's inner mystery. It can be very harmful to suggest to people that everything should be expressed, everything should be let out, let it all hang out, everything should be communicated. It can lead to a lot of different things which aren't very pleasant, to disappointment, to boredom, to emptiness, to a stagnating closeness. We owe it to ourselves and we owe it to others to protect our inner core. He says, it is our human vocation to prevent the harmful exposure of our inner sanctuary, not only for our own protection, but also as a service to our fellow human beings with whom we want to enter into a creative communion. You see, openness loses its meaning when it doesn't come out of a freedom to be closed or an ability. The world is full of empty chatter, hollow talk, easy confessions, senseless complaints, poor praise, and boring confidentialities. Marriage sometimes suffers from the illusion of complete openness. What is important now, and says, is for us to find how to create the boundaries which will allow intimacy, the intimacy of the marriage relationship, to become a new and always surprising discovery of one another. I don't know all there is to know about you. I'm waiting to discover it. There's a reserve. There's more there than I can see or feel or touch now. And it comes forth as a surprise to me every day. Many of you maybe are familiar with the Khalil Gibran thing, which often makes its way into wedding sermons and wedding ceremonies, but it says some of this quite well. Stand not too near together. The oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow. Let each of you be alone, like the strings of a lute. Loneliness. The suggestion now is that our loneliness can perhaps be converted, changed, that we can move from it into something that we might call solitude. We don't do well to deny it, to deny our loneliness. And we may not be able to escape it in the kinds of superficial and maybe idolatrous ways that we have been suggesting, but it may be possible. This is one of Nouwen's nice metaphors, to turn the desert into a garden, to turn the desert of loneliness into the garden of solitude. It's not easy, and yet it may be far simpler than all our striving, all our anxious striving. It takes courage, but it may not be the kind of moralistic courage or the courage of rugged determination or pull yourself up by your bootstraps, by your own bootstraps that we often are trying to deal with. Some of us may have great difficulty believing that this change is even possible for us. I think Nouwen's self-description is very significant here. It was for me. He says, it took me very long to believe this is true. I went to many hoping they would take away my loneliness. But a few said to me, don't run, be quiet, be silent. Listen attentively to your own struggle. Find a deep well under the surface of your complaints. Don't just pour a little water on the dry places. I still doubt if I really believe this, he says. I still cling to people, to books, to events, to experiences, to projects and plans, secretly hoping this time it will be different. S- solitude. It's a strange word. It may suggest strange things to us. It may suggest a hermit. It may suggest someone who goes away from all the traffic into a place alone. It comes from the Latin word solus, does it? Which means alone. Solitude. It's a strange word. It may suggest a hermit. It may suggest someone who goes away from all the traffic into a place alone. It comes from the Latin word solus, does it? Which means alone. Well, there is an element of withdrawal, but it's not necessarily a physical kind of withdrawal, but a withdrawal from distraction. To withdraw from a distracting world, but not necessarily from the world itself. There's a solitude of the heart that can be experienced in the center of the city, in the middle of the crowd, where we're not pulled apart by this and that, where we're not driven and drawn this way and that, but where we observe it, we experience it, and we participate in it all, the center of the city, the middle of the crowd, from a quiet, a confident, a calm center. Can you feel it? It's one thing to be present to a place or a situation or a people in loneliness. It's another thing to be present in solitude. There may be nothing different about the location, but it's a different way of being. It's a different way of being there. And the difference is between being restless and being restful, between being drained and being refreshed. It's the difference between being driven and being free. And it's also the difference between being able to listen to what the other has to say and listening only to hear what I so desperately need to hear. And I pass over everything you're saying to me until you say to me that which seems to promise to give me relief and to take away my loneliness. The difference between being open to what another is saying and being fairly closed so that I hear only what I need for my own interest. Paul Tillich, many of you perhaps know, has a marvelous sermon on loneliness and solitude. If you have a chance to read something, I don't have any books by Nouwen to suggest on this thing, but if you want to read something on this in the course of the day, I suspect that the library has a copy of The Eternal Now, third book of sermons by Paul Tillich, and the first sermon in it is Loneliness and Solitude. He gives us, I think, a helpful description of the two. Our language has wisely sensed these two sides of man's being alone. You see, that's what they have in common, loneliness and solitude. Our being alone. It has created the word loneliness to express the pain of being alone, and it has created the word solitude to express the glory of being alone. And don't we go back and forth, fluctuating between the pain and the glory, the agony and the ecstasy? And we really ought to be careful not to exaggerate our control over that fluctuation. I thought of this again this morning when Walt was talking about the powers which are imposed upon us in life, which we have not willed, which we do not create, but under which we live our life. One of the Niebuhr brothers, H. Richard, I think, says, "We are more acted upon than acting." That may sound, you know, pessimistic, fatalistic. He doesn't mean it that way. The book, the lectures in which he says it are called The Responsible Self. He's urging people to be responsible, and yet we ought to realize we are more acted upon than acting. We ought not exaggerate the control we have over the fluctuation from loneliness to solitude. There are too many known and unknown factors that play roles in our inner life, as well as our outer life. What we can do is to recognize the poles, to recognize the movement, the fluctuation, to be aware, sensitive to them. So that I think our conversations with ourselves might go something like this. Ah, now I'm restless, and I'm lonely. The peace and the quiet and the confidence that I yearn for and sometimes experience are not here now. What can I do to return to them? I don't know. Perhaps right now all I can do is wait. I cannot instantly convert my loneliness into solitude. I can't make an act of the will and change it. But I can refuse to be shaken. I can refuse to be undone by what I'm now feeling. And I can refuse to trust it. And if you or if someone asks me how I'm feeling right now, I'm going to have to say I'm feeling lonely. I'm going to try very hard not to say, "Oh, just fine. How are you?" I'm feeling lonely. I can admit it. I can confess it, at least to myself and perhaps also to you. I will not flaunt it. I won't wear it on my sleeve and hit everybody over the head with it. "I'm very lonely today." But I won't hide it. If I think that you really care about me and want to know where I'm at, you may free me to say to you, "I'm lonely." But I also will not surrender to it, and I will not despair about it. Ah, now I am peaceful. I am quiet, and I am confident. It's strange because I don't know how I got this way. I don't know where it came from. I didn't produce this solitude or bring it about, but here it is. And it is here as a gift to me. I will cherish it. I will hug it. I will say thanks for it. I may not have it tomorrow. I can't trust it that completely. Finally, I've arrived. I've moved from this pole to that. Now I'm finally here. Great, good. I may not have it tomorrow, but then it will be helpful for me to remember today. So I think the conversation within ourselves might be going on as we experience both loneliness and solitude. I want to read some lines from the poet, the German poet, Rainer Maria Rilke, Letters to a Young Poet. I think they say some important things to us here. It's a fellow who wrote to him who was thinking about becoming a poet and who wanted some advice from somebody who had apparently made it as a poet. I don't think they knew each other, apart from this correspondence. It's a little bit like C.S. Lewis's correspondence with the American Lady on Prayer. They knew each other only by correspondence. You ask whether your verses are good. You ask me. You have asked others before me. You send them to magazines. You compare them with other poems. And you are disturbed when certain editors reject your efforts. Now, since you have allowed me to advise you, I beg you to give up all that. You are looking outward, and that above all you should not do now. Nobody can counsel and help you, nobody. There is only one single way. Go into yourself. Search for the reason that bids you write. Find out whether it is spreading out its roots in the deepest places of your heart. Acknowledge to yourself whether you would have to die if it were denied you to write. This above all, ask yourself in the stillest hour of your night, must I write? Delve into yourself for a deep answer. And if this should be affirmative, if you may meet this earnest question with a strong and simple, I must, then build your life according to this necessity. Go into yourself and build your life according to the necessities that are there. In a later letter, he says, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. The point is to love and to live the questions. Not to hurry on to the answer too quickly, but to cherish the question, to love it. You may need to spend some time with it before you can move on some distant day into the answer. Perhaps it's something like that that describes the way human growth and human maturity takes place. When I am lonely, I can say, I want the answer now. I can't wait. I have to have it today. Or I can say, I will listen. I will wait. I will not panic or despair. I will pay respectful attention to what is going on inside. It may be painful, but it may be saying something to me I need to hear. It may be worthy of my love. There's something mysterious about solitude then. And it's not unlike the mystery of God's grace. In fact, there may be a very strong connection, though I'm not going to try to build that this morning, between the two. The mystery of solitude is the mystery of possessing something that finally cannot be produced, but can only be received. And yet it can be noticed, it can be nurtured, it can be encouraged in ourselves and in others. At times it will seem to be out of reach. Nouwen says, the experience of my loneliness is greater than of my solitude. And I must agree, the experience of my loneliness is greater than of my solitude. But he goes on, I have had happy moments of confirmation encouraging me to continue my search for solitude. And I say yes to that. And so finally he says, we may be overwhelmed with loneliness for days and weeks. But once you have tasted this solitude, new life is possible and you will never stop searching for it. Letters of friends are good to receive, but I should be able to live happy without them. Visits are gifts to be valued, but without them I should not fall in the temptation of a brooding mood. Phone calls just to say hello can fill me with gratitude. But when I expect them as a necessary way to sedate my fears of being left alone, I am becoming the easy victim of self-complaints. Living together with friends is an exceptional joy, but my life will be sad if that becomes the aim of my striving. Having a harmonious team working in unity of heart and mind is a gift from heaven. But if my own sense of worth and value depend on that condition, I am a sad man. Friendship and community are the gifts of solitude and can never be claimed, planned, organized. But for those who have felt the pains of loneliness, it is good to know they are hidden in the middle of their suffering. We have a few minutes, perhaps, not as much as I had hoped. Do you want to reflect on this in any way? Respond to it, ask questions, tell how it has been with you.
Well, I think it for me, has demonstrated exactly some experience I went through at all times at Christmas in my work. And it came out exactly the same way.
Yeah.
It was marvelous to come here and searching for something, and this is it.
Yeah.
The difference between the loneliness and the solitude.
Yeah. Yeah. Christmas must be a time when the moving back and forth between those two poles is very, very fast. There must be a lot of traffic on that highway during those weeks.
The most poignant problem for me in one's experience of loneliness, not only my own, but what I see in others, is the problem of not really knowing it when it comes. The problem of not really understanding that I'm a lonely person. Not really knowing what loneliness means. I'm not sure I do know. One of the things that always bothered me about the quote you mentioned was, what if in fact you don't believe that you have to die to do it right? What does that mean for your life? What sort of direction does it take? What is it? If you don't know, if that beauty. A pagan has a nice line that goes, beauty begins at the outer edge of the world. Fundamentally, it is not that solitude is not part of our relationships with other people. But yet, how do we come to know that in our relationships with others? I feel as though part of it begins, I don't know, to some sense of compassion. Seeing it in others and to recognizing the beauty of someone else's loneliness and beginning to appreciate the beauty of pain that we ourselves feel. Pain means us sharing with others something very unique, something very special.
Yeah, you use an expression, the beauty of loneliness. Can you carry that around a little bit further?
Were you going?
No, I asked you whether you want. I have no way, no place to carry it. I wanted you to carry it around a little bit further.
I know. It seems to me to be very hard to place loneliness, place solitude, or to have it mean isolation. Because I think that's a kind of dread that we simply cannot cope with. And in fact, ultimately, we need a fellowship. And maybe solitude is in some sense, awaiting. An ability to wait, a very mature cultivation of the ability to wait for that, not be anxious about it. But I'm not sure that one can experience solitude without other people somehow being ultimately a part of it.
I think the things I've said, the things that Nalin says about this, make that pretty clear. Other people are really important, and yet, we can't invest other people with messianic expectations. We can't lay too heavy a burden on them. So it's not as if, learn to have solitude, learn to get along without other people. That's not the encouragement here. But there is something on the other side which says learn not to be overly dependent on the presence, the affirmation of other people. I suppose we could really draw a lot of theological points here and talk about the way the gospel pushes us from loneliness toward solitude. Huh? I haven't really thought this through in any schematized way, but the way in which it gives us a friend above and beyond all our friends. The way it gives us an affirmation and an acceptance in and through our friends, but not only there, that transcends them. An affirmation and acceptance beyond our friends. When my father and mother give me up, says the psalmist, then the Lord will take me up. So it's not, it's not creating an adversary relationship in the midst of God's good creation. Jesus comments about he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy, and you have to hate your family and all that. Often, we really have to see that in the context of where did the family and where did all these relationships come from? They came to us from God, and Jesus isn't trying to negate God's good gift. He's trying to make a point beyond that. And I think that's the point here. There's not an adversary relationship with other people, but recognize who the Messiah is. Let God be God. Don't make other people your God. Why? Because it will ultimately disappoint. Because it's a hope that will turn to ashes and crumble in your hand and leave you maybe more devastated than before, the last state worse than the first. That's the problem with idolatry, you see. Not that God isn't getting his due, even though we're getting along quite well, thank you. But we're not getting along quite well, or at least it won't last long. Who wants to ride a boat that's going to disintegrate in the middle of the stream or the middle of the ocean? That's what idolatry is all about. That's the problem with it. The God who can be trusted, ultimately, finally.
I like what you had to say about always having to stand between somehow absolute loneliness. One cannot grab onto either one and possess it in the same sense that you can grab onto other people and somehow secure something firm, something which we know will transcend as well as it are on the spiritual. The theological side of that, it seems to me, is that we cannot also have an absolute God, or better, we cannot know an absolute God, but somehow the knowing of Christ, the experience of Christ, is the experience which always exists within that ambiguity that we discover all the time. We're always rediscovering, we never fit in.
Yeah, is it that God is not absolute, or is it that our knowing of him, our experiencing of him is not absolute? I guess I'd put the adverb on the knowing rather than an adjective on the God. Tomorrow we would hope to spend some time with two other words and the movement from hostility to hospitality, our relationships with others. Thank you.